Support for this podcast is brought to you by the Wyoming Humanities. We take a closer look at our human experiences and use stories to explore culture, history, and contemporary issues. You can find us on thinkwhy.org.
Respect and tolerance and empathy and the willingness to agree to disagree, those are the building blocks for our democracy.
Hello, I'm Emmy DeGrappa. This is What's Your Why? Each week we bring you stories asking our guests the question why. We learn about their passion, why they do what they do, why should we care, and what can we learn? What better place to explore the human landscape than from the state known for its incredible landscapes, Wyoming? And what better organization than Wyoming Humanities, serving our state for over 45 years? We share stories, ideas, and wisdom about the human experience. Welcome to What's Your Why? Today, we are talking to Asha Rangappa. She is a senior lecturer at the Yale Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. Asha is also a CNN contributor and a former FBI counterintelligence agent.
Thanks for having me, Emmy.
I'm so glad you're here. It's so curious to learn about how you went from graduating from law school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then becoming an FBI counterintelligence agent. How did that happen?
Well, it wasn't necessarily planned. When I was in law school, I'd gone to law school because I wanted to be a federal prosecutor. And I learned through law school that the path to doing this was typically to graduate from law school and work for a law firm, and then you apply to a U.S. attorney's office. Unfortunately, the summer that I worked at two law firms, it was not the work that I really wanted to do for several years. So I thought, well, what if I apply to the FBI? Maybe this will be a different path to becoming a prosecutor. I'll basically do the order part of Law and Order and, you know, have that experience kicking down doors for a few years and then become a prosecutor. So I applied when I was in law school. That was in 1999. So it was pre-9/11. The Bureau was on a hiring freeze. They weren't really hiring agents at the time. So I was just in their system. But after I graduated from law school, I went and clerked for a federal judge in Puerto Rico. And at the end of that clerkship, 9/11 happened. And then the FBI got a ton of money to hire agents. And I was in their system as a language speaker. So they expedited my application, and 9 months later, I was at Quantico, and I ended up not really kicking down doors. I was catching spies, but it was a great, you know, experience and definitely relevant to a lot of things that's happening now.
A wonderful experience. But what qualifies you? How do they choose federal agents? What is their criteria?
So the FBI actually brings in people with a wide variety of backgrounds, and they call it just the needs of the Bureau. So at the time that I went in, it was when the anthrax attacks were happening. So in my Quantico class, there were actually several scientists. There was a biologist, there was a chemist, there was a literal rocket scientist. People were former law enforcement and military. There was a kindergarten teacher. Yeah, so there was an EMT, a lot of different backgrounds, and I think it's because FBI cases are complex. They're dealing with all kinds of people with all kinds of backgrounds, and they just want a variety of skill sets that are coming to the table. I think these days they're also looking especially for people with computer skills because cyber investigations are so, you know, a huge focus of the Bureau.
Oh, exactly. And so did that career path launch you into becoming an analyst for CNN? How did that happen? How did you make that jump?
Yeah, so that didn't happen directly. When I was doing counterintelligence investigations, as I mentioned, I was catching spies. So this is a part of the Bureau that most people really didn't know about. And the FBI has primary jurisdiction to monitor foreign intelligence activity in the United States.
Right.
So, you know, the CIA doesn't operate within the United States. And I always thought this is all top secret. No one knows or cares about stuff like spies and FISA. So, you know, I just went on with my life. I ended up coming back to Yale Law School, this time as an associate dean. And it was only after the election when there was just all of this public controversy over wiretapping and all of that I started writing, you know, more like legal explainers to say this is how it really works. And that just kind of snowballed. I ended up going on TV to talk about it. And then the next thing I know, I was talking about the FBI and the Mueller investigation. So it's kind of been a whole new, another accidental path that opened up.
And how did social media play into that? Now that you're talking a lot about bridging the gap on social media between what people actually are posting, what's real, what's not real, what's fake news, that kind of, how did you make that jump?
Into being interested in that?
Yes, uh-huh. Well, what was your interest?
Yeah, so this is where I think the counterintelligence background has come into play, because a lot of what I investigated as an FBI agent were what we called perception management campaigns. These are covert operations by foreign intelligence services to try to shape public opinion and attitudes in America towards their country, towards, you know, certain issues or policies. And we try to make sure that the American public is aware of the source of information where they're getting that. Social media has really changed the landscape, because whereas old perception management campaigns might include trying to place a what we call now fake news story in a paper, now they can just put it online and it can get retweeted or shared on Facebook millions and millions of times for free. So this is very low cost for these foreign intelligence agencies. And at the same time, it's very difficult for the FBI to really stop, because we want to respect the First Amendment. We don't want to shut down outlets or channels of communication. So this is how I got interested in kind of bringing this knowledge together to make people aware of what's going on, because it is ultimately invisible.
So how does it actually threaten our democracy?
It threatens our democracy because one of the other ways that social media has changed the landscape is that we can end up in self-created echo chambers, political bubbles. Because on Facebook, for example, you can choose your friends. You can choose the people you follow on Twitter. So you can start only seeing news or ideas that conform to a worldview that get you entrenched in how you see the world. And what's happened is that we now have kind of two different realities that people are living in, and they're not connecting and really seeing a shared set of facts or values that they're working from. And when we end up in political tribalism, and we don't have those shared values of respect and tolerance and empathy and, you know, the willingness to agree to disagree, those are the building blocks for our democracy. And I think especially when we start having people questioning the legitimacy of our institutions, like law enforcement or our courts, it becomes bad, because then people start to lose faith in really what our democracy is about.
So define political tribalism. Where does that term come from?
I don't know where it comes from. I think it's
very popular right now.
Yeah, there is actually a book out, and I quoted it in my talk called Political Tribes by my colleague at Yale Law School named Amy Chua, and she describes this phenomenon. But it's really a way in which we retreat into kind of cocoons where we believe that we share certain characteristics, and then we exclude people who don't. And so this could be Republicans versus Democrats. It could be based on, you know, Christians and non-Christians. All of these kinds of tribes that in moderate ways can be healthy, when they're taken to an extreme, can become exclusionary and factionalizing and toxic. And I think that's where we are headed if we don't start to self-correct.
And how do we self-correct? How can we protect ourselves from getting into that bubble where that's all we see, that's all we know, and we don't know how to go outside of it to educate ourselves on a bigger scale, or even how do we know what's real and not real in the news?
Yeah. I think there's two things. One is to actually engage with viewpoints that are different with ours. And I think it's more than just be like exposing oneself to it, not just like reading your daily article from, you know, the publication that you would normally not agree with, but to engage with people who hold those views and get and start to approach it with a sense of curiosity.
why do you feel that way? And because that's how you're going to get to perhaps some common ground by engaging with people. And I think human interaction is the other thing that we've really lost in this digital age. And maybe just bringing normal, you know, humanity back into the way that we deal with each other so that we have a certain level of trust in our fellow citizens, even if we get to a point where we might vote differently or disagree.
What is your passion right now in trying to get that message out? How are you going to do that? Do you have a plan? Do you have a tactic? What do you think?
I don't have a bigger idea right now than to just make people aware of it. So again, to bring this back to my experience as a counterintelligence agent for the Bureau, one of the things that our goal was to neutralize foreign intelligence operations. And that means to make them ineffective. And the way that you do that with perception management campaigns, which are basically secretly trying to get you to think certain ways, is to expose them and say, this is what Russia is trying to do. They're trying to divide us. They're trying to make us fight with each other. They're trying to pit us against each other as a way of weakening us and our democracy. And I'm hoping that by letting people see visually, you saw that I had some graphs that are very powerful in terms of these political bubbles that social media creates, that people might be able to become more self-aware and observe their own ways that they are complicit in that. And I think we're all guilty of helping facilitate that kind of tribalism, as we just talked about. And I think we can over time work our way out of it.
So just in a real way, explain how Russia compromised our election.
Right. So they worked on a number of fronts. And these are called active measures. They're essentially covert operations that are using, you know, means to, again, make us lose faith in the legitimacy of our processes. So we know that they hacked emails of the political parties. We know that they intruded into some states' voting machines. We know that they may have been illegally funneling campaign contributions. And then the piece that I focus on is their use of social media to essentially send ads and messages and even creating events to pit groups on different sides of emotionally charged issues like immigration, like gay rights, gun rights, to basically get them to fight with each other, to get us to, you know, hate the other side.
So as a nation, they're just trying to polarize us and separate us from each other so that we don't think together.
That's right. That's right. And to basically weaken the social fabric because it's, you know, the policies we have are secondary to this idea that we all believe in a shared vision of America and its democratic ideals, regardless of how you vote, whether you're red or blue. But once we lose that, those shared ideals, this shared vision of America as kind of this beacon of, you know, freedom and democracy and, you know, the rule of law, then we don't have much left. I think our democracy is more fragile than people believe, and we really shouldn't take it for granted.
Exactly.
That we'll always have that.
Mm-hmm. What is your best advice for young people right now? since they are so vulnerable, they're on social media all the time,
mm-hmm.
and you probably have a lot of those young people in your classes at Yale. What do you try and help them see?
Yeah, they're, you know, what's interesting is that they are really the first generation who has grown up in the digital age and with social media. And I don't know that they know the kind of human interaction that really creates community. I mean, I don't know about you, Emmy, but when I was little, you know, I left on Saturday mornings on my bike. I knocked on my friends' doors to see if they could play. We went around, you know, and as long as I showed up at 6 and wasn't dead, like, my parents were okay. And now, you know, not only are their lives so managed, but a lot of it is happening over text and email and Snapchat and Facebook and Twitter. And they don't have the same kind of socialization into knock on somebody's door, you know, go and sit down with somebody and have the conversation in person. And I think that that is where we want to start steering them, you know, to create the habits that actually create community.
I agree with you 100%. I'm just trying to picture how we go back. You know, maybe there will be a rebirth of community. I think people do crave that. I think people need people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there will be a new
grassroots kind of way of
right.
Yeah.
Where you have those kinds of neighborhood interactions.
Yeah, I think those need to come back. You know, and some of the examples that I put up at the end of my talk the other night, like communities that are getting people together to watch, you know, disparate communities to come together to watch the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. you know, or to just have meetups where you know who your neighbors are. I think it could be like as simple as that, as beginning with those small steps, because the way we've gotten ourselves into it is incrementally. So mm-hmm. there's not going to be some huge shift that we're going to be able to do in the next 6 months to get us out. It's going to take small steps
right.
in one direction.
And time.
Yeah.
Yep. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Emmy.
Thank you for listening. I'm Emmy DeGrappa. This Think Why podcast is brought to you by the Wyoming Humanities. We use the humanities as a lens to explore the human experience. You can find us online at thinkwhy.org.